Hello and welcome. I'm Alexander, and this is Knee Deep in Tech, covering the latest from the IT industry with a specific focus on Microsoft and how to get actual value from technology. This is episode 128, recorded on the 22nd of July, 2020. You will be able to find this and our previous episodes on kneedeepintech.com, iTunes, Spotify, and on most podcasting platforms. So this is a bit of a special episode because the trio, we're still on vacation. But I had the amazing opportunity to interview Don Jones, and I took it. Enjoy. And we are joined now by a bit of a legend, Mr. Don Jones. Don, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So I'm sure that almost anybody who has not lived under a rock for the last 20 odd years knows who you are, but could you please give us a short introduction on who you are, what you do, and why you do what you do?
Yeah. So I've been in the IT industry since probably the mid 90s, and I got into training and education pretty rapidly, probably late 90s. And that's kind of where I've spent most of my career. Right now I work for Pluralsight. I work on the content development team. And I have done training all over the world in a pretty broad variety of topics. I've helped career changers who were doing night classes at Penn State University get their MCSE for the first time way back in the day. That's kind of, you know, my whole career has kind of revolved around training and helping people pick themselves up and do more.
And how did you actually get into training? Because most of the people that I talk to that are trainers, they when they get the question, they go, I never planned it this way, but, and then comes this amazing story.
I was collecting. So I had my MCSE and a couple of specializations, and I said, you know, the next big thing is the MCT, and so I want to get that. I was working for Bell Atlantic at the time, and we had an ILT training partner. And so I went to them and said, you know, look, can you, I think this is what I want to do. Can you tell me more about it? They helped me get my MCT. They're the ones who had me teaching night classes at Penn State University, just outside of Philadelphia. And that went well enough that when the classes wrapped up, they offered me a job. I wound up running their training and certification group, wound up running their entire technical services team. We developed courseware and everything else. And it just kind of went from there.
It's interesting. So starting with the MCSE, and I think everybody knows the old MCSE stuff. Did you by any chance have the MCSE plus I?
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 My first MCSE was the NT4. And then I kept adding whatever they came out with. I was collecting. This was, I think before people realized badging was a thing that works in people's brains, but it was happening.
Yeah, I started with the NT4 as well. And people look at me and go, dude, how old are you? And yes, I have some white in my beard, but come on. So being around since like forever, how has the training landscape changed in your view, both from a purely technical perspective, but also how do you actually approach the concept of training?
Yeah, it's definitely changed a bunch. I mean, back in the day, it was definitely ILT. You went to a class for a week, you sat in a room. I'm not sure that was particularly effective. I think we were just copying the models that we had all grown up with going to school and maybe college, but that's what you did. I think now there's a lot more recognition that people's time is limited, people's attention spans are limited, their ability to pull off and do training is limited. So as we've kind of moved toward a world where online training is a thing, it's accepted, people do it, it's self-paced, it's video, it's written, it's whatever, we've I think out of necessity started to shift towards smaller chunks of learning that people can spread out on their own or learn just the thing they need right now. And I don't think we necessarily did that out of any great, you know, regard for cognitive science, but it turns out that is cognitively the right thing to do for adult human beings. So I think we've just kind of been pushed in the right direction by the economics of the thing, and it turned out to be the right direction.
And that's, I think I have to agree, because the monolithic 5 days in a course, almost not getting allowed to go to the bathroom, is difficult, both from a training perspective and the learner perspective.
Yeah, it's too much.
And at the same time, I'm sure you're familiar with the way that Microsoft has changed their training concepts when it comes to the role-based training as opposed to the I don't know, the product-based trainings, I think there's?
Yeah, we would call it functional training.
Oh, yeah, right. So would you say that that is kind of moving in the same direction as smaller chunks and nuggets and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it is. So there's what you're delivering, and people are tending now to focus more on job roles. Like, let me help prepare you for a job role. And then there's the how you deliver, the actual mechanics of it, and delivering things in smaller chunks, maybe assessing people first so you can figure out which chunks they need so they're not sitting through stuff that they already know or is maybe not applicable to them. I think the industry in general is getting better than that. It's funny. You know, there's the learner's desire for what they need. And a lot of that is driven by what they need right now. And that's where we start on Google and we ask a question and we wind up on YouTube or someone's blog or whatever else. Then you've got the vendors like Microsoft that have definitely got a different motivation. They want people using Azure more. And if you don't know how to use Azure, then you're not going to use it more. And so for them, these role-based things are a way of going to a technology leader and saying, hey, we're going to train your people to be a XYZ, therefore you will feel comfortable spending lots of money with us. So the motivations are a little bit different. I think everybody gets to a good place in the end, but you do have to recognize when you're coming at it from the other direction that those motivations exist, and you've got to be aware of those and make sure that you're also looping back to what does the learner actually need out of this? I think that's an area where a lot of trainers, I think, kind of get lost in the weeds. You know, they're given materials from a vendor like a Microsoft or an Amazon or whomever, and they get really focused on delivering that material and sometimes forget to stick their head above water and ask, what is it that the learner is after here?
Yes, very much so, yes. And the first time I came across your name was actually when I picked up the instructional design for Mere Mortals.
Oh, yeah.
And it resonated so much with me because it is all about taking away the extraneous fluff that is so prevalent in training materials of today. Yeah. How did you come up with writing that book? Because as you say in your bio, it's for the people that doesn't have a PhD in training sciences.
Yeah. I didn't go to college at all. And so I kind of started at a little bit of a handicap with understanding some of these things. And I listened to really good trainers. I would read really good books, but a lot of them felt very academic, and it took a long time for me to synthesize because it wasn't speaking to me in a way that just kind of naturally meshed. And I think what a lot of people forget, you know, when you decide to become a trainer, even back when the MCT was really a thing and there was a whole train the trainer class you had to do, they were really teaching you tactics. They were teaching you mechanical things. You know, make sure you stand up and introduce yourself. Make sure you establish dominance so that no one else feels they can ask you a question that you might not know the answer to. It's all these little tactical things. And it's honestly really toxic. And I started to really hate that as I got more into it. And I started to understand what I was doing. And so I took the time to sit down and try and digest some cognitive science and understand what happens in people's brains when they are participating in a learning experience. And it's not really hard. It's just you only have one or two books out there on cognitive science, ones that speak down to you or ones that really speak down to you. Like, nobody wants to talk at you or with you. And so I wanted to write a book that kind of distilled a lot of what I was finding to be effective from cognitive science into just normal English words, you know, and there are a lot of techniques, but there's a lot of just understanding how the brain physically puts information together. You know, people forget that our brains were designed to keep us alive in the wild and fed and survival. And most of our learning mechanisms are still tied into those patterns. And you can use those, like even if you just want to use them on yourself as a learner, but you can exploit those things to make your brain do the things it's designed to do. But on the other hand, when you decide that, you know, I'm just going to do it this other way, it's like taking a 747 and trying, you know, doing loops with it. You can do it, but it's really not what it's made for, and it's no one's going to enjoy it.
No one's going to enjoy that at all. True enough. And what I find, and I'm super curious to hear your opinion on this, with the role-based or the functional-based training, it becomes like these stovepipes that you kind of find yourself having material between the pipes that are not quite covered. If you're doing it from a technical or product perspective, then you can cover everything. It is boring as heck, but you can cover the whole shebang, which you cannot do with the functional or the role-based. How would you say that this can be rectified, and how do you approach that kind of training conundrum?
I'm actually not sure it's always a problem. So if you take an administrator who is, let's say, an entry-level Active Directory administrator working on-prem in an environment, that's a job role. They don't need to know everything. They need to know what they need to do their job. And the quickest path from point A to point B, like if what the learner wants is to do a job, that's point B. Where they are now is point A. The quickest path is the minimum amount of information to get them to B. Like, you gotta, as a trainer, there's this desire to share, you know, I know so much and I've been through so much and I've had these experiences and I want to prevent you from making the same mistakes I did. I just want to share it all. Yeah, but you got to ratchet it back. Like, that might be the first class that new administrator is taking, but it won't be the last. They will get there eventually, but you can't just slam the human brain with a fire hose of unrelated information. You may have shared it, but none of it stuck. You didn't do anyone any good. You didn't achieve anything. So I think the real key with role-based training is to be very, very critical and selective about what you're teaching. And you've got to really do your research on it. And that's where the danger of getting it wrong is if you don't take the time to fully understand what that role is, you may leave some important stuff out and you may add some stuff that frankly nobody cares about. That's where I do see vendors go wrong a lot. They start off with great intentions. We're going to do role-based training, but then it goes through a review with the product people. And the person who just spent 8 months of their life developing this feature loses their brain because their feature is not being covered. And you're like, well, yeah, but like, that's pretty niche case. You know, there's only 8 customers who use that. No, I insist. And so now we wind up, you know, teaching, or even worse, having certification exams on features that don't really fit the job profile that we came up with in the first place.
I have to agree, and especially with the small detail about the certification tests.
Yeah.
That's a whole different topic that we could spend weeks talking about.
Weeks.
Nobody would enjoy that either. So where does this leave remote training? I mean, if someone would have asked me a couple of months back, can I do really, really good remote training? I would probably have said, yeah, but it's not the same thing. I've done some remote training and it has been various degrees of disaster, to be absolutely fair. Then the world ended.
It's hard. You know, I think it comes back to, we as an industry haven't necessarily spent a lot of time thinking about what's good for the learner and the learner's human organic brain. We've taken this model of you go and sit in school all day. And we've cast that as the class A first, you know, citizen experience. And then everything else tries to add up to that and mimic that or you know, simulate that or whatever else. And I think that the idea itself is flawed because we've no evidence that that training model actually works for human beings. And we've quite a bit of evidence that it doesn't. Even a kid in 10th grade, they're not sitting in class for 8 hours learning one subject, right? They're doing an hour of English and an hour of math, and that shifts their brain to a different place. That can be made to work so long as you're teaching fairly structured, general, generic types of topics. I went to vocational school, VoTech, my last 2 years of high school. We spent 3 hours a day in VoTech, and that was electronics and computer repair, but I didn't spend 3 hours of every day in a classroom. We had maybe an hour of theory, and then we went into the lab and we started working on the things. Now, that's what a lot of technical training really tries to do, is give you a little bit of lecture, give you a little bit of concept, and then get you into it and working through it. And that is effective, but there's no reason you have to be in a class moving at the same pace as everybody else and doing that. Adults in particular, like once you hit 25 and your prefrontal cortex firms up out of jello and becomes brain matter, how you learn changes. People say kids are sponges. They're not really. They just don't have any filters. Whereas as adults, we have filters. We take information in and we're critical about it and we try to apply it to things. We have to teach adults differently than we teach kids. And that might mean that, you know, blowing away the old model and going with something like, hey, I'm going to give you an hour long video, and then we're going to have a little 15-minute hands-on experience in a cloud lab. And then there's some written stuff I want you to go through. That might actually be better. And it's self-paced. People can go through their, you know, at their own speed, everything else. We're actually starting to see that not just in the technical world. I don't know if you're familiar with Western Governors University's program and how they're structured, but you pay for your class, you show up, you take an assessment. If the assessment says, you know what, you got this, go take the exam, go take the final test for this course. Oh, look, you passed. You don't need to sit in this. Here's your credits. Have a good day. Like, that's how adults work well. And I think that, you know, with platforms like Pluralsight and people being able to use Google and everything else, we're starting to see that become more of an everyday thing. I think there will come a point where people look back at classroom training and they're like, wow, how primitive. Like, how did we ever get by when that's what we were doing? And it's not that having an expert live with you can't be helpful, right? You know, have someone come in to do a workshop, get the team together, have some group activities that the team can work on just like they do in production. That can be an effective part of it, but it's the sum of the whole. It's all these things coming together that I think we really are starting to see a shift to.
Yeah, and I definitely agree. And when you say filters, would you agree that filters are also kind of a preconception? So we not only need to pass through the filter, we need to pass through a preconception as to if the learner can actually apply whatever information we try to push down their throat.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I talked to people when I was training folks on desired state configuration. I realized that the first thing we had to get past was, well, my company doesn't do anything like this and they never will. Yeah, that might be true. However, let me pitch you a couple of scenarios where your company might use this, like maybe not enterprise wide, but here's a couple of small areas, because if you can't get past that gate, then it's a wall. Like, nobody wants to keep talking to you. So you really have to understand where your learners are coming from, where point A is, before you can start talking about point B.
Yeah. So in essence, it's like with a lot of other things in life, you need a clearly defined why.
Yeah.
So my wife is a Japanese teacher, and one of the things that she's been talking about is the flipped classroom approach. Do you know what that is? I suppose you do.
Yeah.
And do you see that the flipped classroom where you basically hand out all the information beforehand and then you go to the students to do a workshop on that material? How do you see that in training with technical stuff?
I think it's amazingly effective. So that's basically a restatement of an instructional design theory from the early 1900s called constructionism. And it posits that you don't have a teacher, you have a facilitator. One of the first books I ever wrote was a .NET framework programming class for high schools. And the anchor was, I had to write a book that a non-programmer teacher could deliver, because the school systems just didn't have people. You know, they were taking math teachers and assuming that would be sufficient. And it occurred to me that the vast majority of what we do as technologists, like most of our learning, doesn't happen in formal settings. It happens on Google or browsing, you know, Microsoft Learn or Wikipedia or whatever, right? We have to be self-teachers to get by. It's the only way we can do it. And so I wrote the book with exactly what we're saying. We're going to start by talking about what MSDN is, and we're going to explore that and look at how that's broken down. That's a very easy thing. You know, it's just a guided exploration. Anybody can read the script there. Okay, here's Visual Studio. I'm going to kind of walk you through what this means. We're going to do one very small thing. Now that I've given you all the tools, here's a very small task that's completely within your scope, but you're going to have to learn a couple of things, and you already know where to go do it. And the instruction to the teacher was, you know, well, what if the student has a question? Point them back to MSDN. Because ultimately, that's what they have to learn to do. They have to learn to stand up on their own. I think it's extremely effective. It can be a little frustrating for adult learners. Like, high school kids will give you some trust. And if you can get them engaged, I think the project we had them working on was like a Star Trek game, right? So they got interested in it. But with adults, there's so much fear of failure that if you sit people down and are like, go, you know, be successful, here's the tools, a lot of people will just lock up. I've been in ILT situations where, and you know how it is, right? You've got the computer, you're running 8 virtual machines. You can push a button and blow those things back to the starting point. There's no danger at all. And folks will say, well, what happens if I run this command? I don't know. You're sitting in front of a computer, run the command. Well, what if it breaks? I don't care. We'll reset it. Run the command. And there's just this massive wall of fear around any sort of failure or not knowing what I'm doing, and everyone else is going to see, and I'm going to look stupid, and oh my God. So it's tougher to do that with adults. You can do it, but you have to go into it very deliberately and tell them what you're doing so they can go, okay, like I see the game we're playing. And then you can try and get them to play along.
Sounds very reasonable. And the thing that I keep hearing here is the ego of the learner, not as if the learner is having a huge ego, but they are generally finding, in my view, this kind of training more scary because they are going to do more things wrong.
Yeah, I wrote a PowerShell class that is still marketed through Microsoft's courseware marketplace. And, you know, because it's not Microsoft's official curriculum, I don't have to follow the rules and the patterns and everything else. So I did what I know is the right thing for the learner. I'm like, here's the lab. Well, it should be step one, type these words, step two, present. I'm like, no, because I can't come hold your hand at work either. You're going to have to do this. And yeah, it's going to feel a little bit scary. But once you've done it here in the safe, warm embrace of the classroom, once you've done it, it won't be scary out in the real world anymore. So sometimes it's tough love. You know, you've actually got to tell people, look, this is what we're doing, and I can't come hold your hand there. And this class is about teaching you, not just getting through the week.
And suddenly I don't have to ask the question about the railroaded labs that I had lined up. Yes. I agree completely. So how does the fact that whatever we're teaching literally changes overnight? I usually, whenever I introduce myself at a conference, say that I wrote a Pluralsight course. It was relevant for all of 2 weeks. And then Microsoft changed half the Power BI, which is true. Yeah. Don't ever go on vacation. How does the ever-changing and extremely fast-paced changing of the technical landscape change training, in your view? Does it change it at all?
It just tells us that the week-long ILT class is an even worse idea than we already thought it was, right? I can't go through a week of training every month just to keep up. Smaller chunks, and really recognizing, and this is a case where I think a lot of enterprises in particular create a toxic relationship. You know, they have these LMS, learning management systems. They keep track of, you know, which courses you've watched and all that. They only recognize one type of training, and that's the training they can measure. You went to a class, you watched a video. That's kind of where they end. But what about when I was just, you know, reading so-and-so's blog on a Microsoft website and I'm learning about some changes that they're making to the technology in the next version that's coming out next week? That's learning. I learned. I was taught. I'm ready now. We don't recognize that as learning, right? People believe that unless they're in a formal learning situation, they're not learning. But all of that is learning, and we need to find ways to apply value to that. You know, we need to stop measuring the learning activity and start measuring the learning outcome. Are you able to do your job? And how much time do I need to carve out of the day to make sure you can keep up with that? And that's another thing. And I wrote a book called The Culture of Learning. And the main posit is that leaders in most businesses do not know how to lead learners. They do not know how to make learning a business outcome. And it's not that they can't, it's just they've never thought of it for the most part. But if you can carve time out of the day for stand-ups and meetings and birthday cakes and all the other crap that we manage as part of our day, then you can make that one of your production outcomes as well. I think most of us are pretty clear that a technologist's most useful career skill is the ability to learn. If you can teach yourself something, you are future-proofed. We need to carry that into leadership. Learning and keeping up and keeping your people skilled up is the most important production outcome, because no matter what happens to the business, you're going to be able to respond with the people you've got. You're not going to have to go out into the job market, God help you, which nobody wants to do. It's painful. We're all too introverted to want to do that. You don't want to buy people as a way of solving your business problems. You want to be able to do it with the team you've got. There are some companies that are fantastic at this, but they're unfortunately, they're a little few and far between. I think it's something that every single leader really should start to think about is what am I doing to have a self-learning, self-capable team that can pivot their brains however I might need them to.
A few times I have the opportunity to interview people, and it feels like I'm talking to myself. You're really putting words to thoughts that I've had, but I've not been able to put words to. It's super, super interesting. And it also, it kind of leads to what makes a good trainer in your view, because from what I'm hearing is that the technical ability is almost secondary.
It is almost secondary. I do not think the best teachers I've ever been with have been great subject matter experts. I had math is my least favorite formal school topic, but I had a really good algebra teacher who got me through. She didn't win a Nobel Prize for mathematics. She was not a subject matter expert by any stretch, but what she could do is the heart of teaching. You take information and knowledge that someone else has produced and you repackage it for your audience. That's what teaching is. It's not about being an expert. Like we could just all go read the documentation, right? It's all out there. Well, no, because you know some people just don't have the background context to even understand the documentation. Ah, now we're talking. You're repackaging, and that's all we do. And so the key to being a really good teacher is to understand your audience, know their context, know where they come from, know where they're trying to go. Make sure they know they can trust you to get them from point A to point B in as smooth a road as possible with as few side paths as possible. I get frustrated. I'll sit down and, I'll catch snippets of someone's class or video or something else, and they'll start telling a story. And I'm like, oh, good. I love stories. Stories are great teaching devices. But the story has nothing to do with what we're talking about. I'm like, dude, they need to know this. Well, for who? Do they need to know it, or do you want them to know it? Like, you can't teach selfishly. Teaching is an act of selflessness. Like, you have to let go of your own ego and really just do what's right for those people in front of you. And that group is going to be different. And if you're doing a video, you might acknowledge that I might have to do this video 5 different ways for different types of people to really latch onto it. If I'm teaching live, conference or in a classroom, I'm going to have to really ask some questions and understand where they are. And I'm going to have to adapt my delivery as I go. It's not a script. I think that's really, really the key is understanding that you're there to do a service for someone else and they are trusting you. And you just need to walk that bright line that gets them there.
And I'd love to circle back to the state of the MCT, the Microsoft Certified Trainers. Would you say that the curriculum being designed and the way that the MCT is marketed is in line with how training, in your view, should be done?
No. I think we all know that's not the case. Look, if you're writing Microsoft official curriculum, your first constraint is it has to be deliverable by an MCT. And that's not presented as a complimentary statement. There's a lot of market pressures. The people who are MCTs want to do a good job. They are often working for training companies that are extremely constrained financially. It is not a high margin space. It's almost like, why can't we get really, really good people in public service? Well, because you can make so much damn more money privately. And that's the case. If you're truly a subject matter expert, if you're truly amazing at what you do, most of those training companies can't afford to hire you. And so the people who become really, really good kind of, age out, so to speak. They become too good for that space and they go on and do bigger and better things. So just the financials of it means that program kind of exists around a high entry level, to low practitioner level, which is not ideal. The whole model is built around keeping a trainer utilized. I hate that word when it's applied to a human being though, right? We want them 75% utilized. I'm like, well, that's crap. You want them 100% utilized. You just know you'll burn them out if you've got them in the classroom 52 weeks out of the year. So you're thinking about it wrong. The model is wrong. You're really not helping your students that way. they're not learning. They're perhaps, so I have this weird thing. There's a lot of words that I trigger on, and trainer is one of them. And I hate the word trainer. Trainers are for dogs and dolphins, not human beings. But most of the ILT classes you're going to, trainer is an accurate word. You are teaching someone to jump through hoops and to repeat a set of tasks, not to think critically, not to understand, not to synthesize information to a higher understanding of why and what they're doing. So I really prefer teach, because that's what we do with human beings, to lift them up and make them better and expand their brains and expand their opportunities. We just don't always get the opportunity to do that because of the economics around learning.
Yeah, I have to agree. The only issue with the word teacher, that it is, I can't call myself a teacher.
It's regulated. Yes. Yeah, it's regulated. Yeah.
But that's true. So we're, as is most often the case with very interesting people that I get to talk to, is we're kind of running out of time. But how would you say that the things that we've talked about from a teacher perspective, how would you say that they are applicable to other aspects of life, for instance, public speaking or basically anything in any day?
I think anything. Like if the core of being a good teacher is knowing who your learner is and what they need and what they're trying to achieve and helping them get there with as less fuss as possible, change the words. If the goal of a good business is to really understand who your customer is and what they're dealing with and how what they need and getting them there with as little fuss as possible. If you're, you know, presenting, who is your audience, right? It's really, why are you there and what do you solve for? If you are a solution, what is your problem? And we don't think about that a lot. Oh, well, I'm a trainer and the problem is people need to learn. Meh, let's be a little more specific than that. Why do they need to learn? They just didn't wake up in the morning and go, got a hankering to learn. Learn me some stuff, man. Why are they there? What problem are they dealing with? That's business 101, right? That's why businesses exist. And teaching is a form of business. You know, we are solving a problem for a customer who is probably paying some money for it. So it's really understanding that. I think that really comes true in a lot of public education in the United States, where, you know, if you're not paying for it, then who is? So if you're a public school teacher, the student is not your customer. They're not the ones paying for it. The school district is really your customer, and what they care about are high passing scores on standardized exams. And that's what we see public education pointing to, and we know it's toxic. But that's what happens when the wrong customer is in charge.
Yep, you get exactly what you solve for, as you put it.
Yeah.
So could we have three tips? Very clickbaity, but three tips from Don Jones for a trainer that, having listened to this interview, realized that they need to up their game. What can a normal trainer, if you will, do to really up their game in your view?
I think spend a little time on cognitive science. There's a book called How We Learn. Obviously, I have Instructional Design for Mortals. Spend a little time understanding how the human brain learns and learn to take advantage of that, leverage those things. Number two, understand why you're there. Really sit down and have some deep insight with yourself about why you exist as a educator and what you are solving for. And I think number three is let go of this idea that you have to be an expert. That's not what you're there for. There's lots of experts in the world. Teachers are able to repackage and communicate and use analogies and other teaching devices to convey information. That's a powerful skill. The cross section of super expert and teaching ability, it doesn't happen all that often. It doesn't need to, right? That's not what you're there for. You're not there to be the one who knows everything about it, and you never will be. Embrace what you are there for and do a stellar job at that.
And that is probably the best end of an interview I've ever had. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Yeah, happy to. Loved it.